I really credit a doctor that I actually live pretty close to right now, just like right down the road, to like sort of lighting the match for my eating disorder. I was in pain. I was 25. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was farming for work. But, you know, I couldn't do physical labor anymore. And, you know, the naturopathic doctor essentially told me to cut out all carbohydrates and that that would resolve my issues, you know. And I think about it now in the healthcare field, and I'm like, what? That is a, you know, that's insane. I try not to use that language because it's very ableist, but like, that's not an evidence-based recommendation.
Welcome to Behind the Bite, where we delve deep into the real-life struggles and triumphs surrounding food, body, and weight. I'm Dr. Christina Castanini, a psychologist and certified eating disorder specialist, bringing you a unique blend of personal experience as a recovered individual with over 25 years of professional expertise. In each episode, we'll share the courageous journeys of individuals who have faced these challenges firsthand, alongside insights from dedicated professionals in the field. Whether you're seeking healing, inspiration, or simply a deeper understanding, this podcast is here to empower you on your own path to a better life. Join us as we explore stories of resilience, discuss the latest insights, and strive to foster a community of support and growth. Together, we can break down barriers, challenge stigma, and pave the way towards healing and living authentically. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to today's show. Today, it's for the person who looks like they're doing everything quote unquote right, but secretly feels like food has taken over their brain. Maybe that's you. Maybe it's somebody you know. Because sometimes when you have an eating disorder or disordered eating, it doesn't show up how people think. It doesn't show up as starvation. It can show up as like purity, as quote unquote clean, as, hey, I'm just being quote unquote healthy. And when you're doing that, your life kind of slowly shrinks until your worth is measured by what you ate, what you didn't eat, and whether you followed all the rules. And my guest today, Virginia, she's an eating disorder dietitian and the founder of The Radical Dietitian. She's been doing this work for nearly a decade, and she also brings a deeply personal lens because she's lived what so many people are living right now, orthorexia, where the food is like quote unquote medicine, their pipeline, the way that wellness culture can, you know, quietly turn food into this obsession, and it becomes something they fear, and you become very disconnected from yourself and your body. And today, Virginia and I are going to talk about how orthorexia often starts with a perfectly understandable desire to feel better, and then how it can escalate really fast into pain, digestion issues, anxiety, and a need for control, and again, really shrink your life. And also, we're going to talk about why recovery can feel really brutal, especially when your body changes and the people around you are still steeped in diet culture. And we're also going to touch on the grief and identity shifts that happen when your eating disorder was your structure, your plan, your safety, and how to navigate that. And Virginia's going to bring up something about living in your head versus living in your body and what that actually means and how confusing all that can feel at first. Don't worry about that. Again, we're going to get all into all of this. And then, you know, it's really going to be a great conversation with her where we're just going to talk about the truth that nobody says out loud enough, that your body was never the problem to solve. The system that taught you to fear your body is. And I especially want you to hear that if you're scared that recovery means you'll lose everything, approval, desirability, belonging, compliments, your identity of being quote unquote the healthy one, well, we're gonna go into all of that with a lot of honesty and a lot of compassion. So if you've ever thought, hey, I can't stop thinking about food, I don't even know what I like anymore, I'm afraid if I let go, I'll be out of control, or hey, I just wanna feel peaceful in my body, this episode is for you. So I want you to take a breath. You're not broken. You're not failing. You're responding to a culture that profits from your self-doubt. I'm gonna go get Virginia and we're gonna get into it. All right. Well, Virginia, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
It's really nice to have you, and I'm excited to talk to you. So as always with most of my guests, I do ask a little bit about like your journey and how you got here. So if you wouldn't mind, it'd be great if you could just tell us a little bit about your story, and then we can kind of delve into more, about like what you do. And I'd love to hear how you got here.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see my story. Where do I start? I have a history of orthorexia, which is an eating disorder that's not currently in the DSM, although there's a big push within the community to get it in the DSM because clinically we're seeing a lot of those behaviors in the eating disorder field. So I was in my early 20s, I moved out to the Pacific Northwest from the East Coast and got involved with the environmental community out here, was doing restoration work. And this was in 2005. And I was 22, and there was a really big environment around sort of like back to the land. People were really interested in sustainable agriculture. And alongside of that, there was a lot of food stuff. And I mean, I was a 22-year-old female, so there's always like a lot of food stuff, but those two things went together. And I started working at a small community supported agriculture farm. And that was a wonderful experience for me. I'm still very involved with sustainable farming and agriculture, and work for my friend's farm still on the weekends sometimes when I have the capacity. And yeah, it was really in that space where I started to think about food as a way to heal. And I had a pretty major back injury while I was farming. I herniated a disc in my low back. I was 25. And I would say I had disordered eating before that. But my process of healing from the back injury, and then I had a bunch of digestive issues crop up. I sought out naturopathic healthcare because I felt drawn to that. And I really credit a doctor that I actually live pretty close to right now, just like right down the road, to like sort of lighting the match for my eating disorder. I was in pain. I was 25. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was farming for work, but, you know, I couldn't do physical labor anymore. And, you know, the naturopathic doctor essentially told me to cut out all carbohydrates and that would resolve my issues, you know. And I think about it now in the healthcare field, and I'm like, what? That is a, you know, that's insane. I try not to use that language because it's very ableist, but like that's not an evidence-based recommendation. But I did it, you know, and lots of people do. This is what I see clinically, is people are suffering and they get food recommendations that, you know, there may or may not be evidence behind. And if you're looking for relief, you're going to double down on it, which is exactly what I did. And that was the time where I was like, you know, there was like a whisper in the back of my mind around, I don't think this is okay. You know, I was thinking about food all the time. I was making everything from scratch. I was obsessed with purity, clean eating. And, you know, all of that was to feel some relief for the pain and the digestive issues that I was having. And it didn't work. But I ended up, I ended up getting some part-time work after like a year when I was able to work again, and started taking prerequisites to get my master's degree in nutrition and dietetics. And it was sort of, you know, motivated by like, how can I help people heal through food? I was really like in that food is medicine mentality. And so I went to a local university here, Bastyr University, small private university that really, you know, models that food is medicine, food is healing. And I kind of got there in that those years were my first dissonance points around like, you know, people like, wow, people are so obsessed with cleanliness, purity in their food. Right. Like it kind of reflected back my own reality to me. And I was just like, I don't think this is actually it. You know, I don't think that this is health. I think that this is sort of obsessive. And, you know, I started asking questions. I have an undergraduate degree in sociology around who has access to this. You know, what I was learning in school is like every meal plan is like oatmeal for breakfast, a kale salad for lunch, salmon for dinner. You know, like that's the intervention on all of these chronic diseases. And it's like, I mean, I'm exaggerating here, right? But like that's the mentality. And it's like, who has access to that? Who has time and energy to do that? Only a certain amount of people.
It's true.
So yeah, really started to kind of crack, I call them dissonance points in my work. That's that place where it's kind of reflected back to you. I'm laughing to myself because I'm thinking of another dissonance point. My partner at the time, you know, when I was really sort of in the height of my disorder, we were in the grocery store, we were in the chips aisle. We were like on vacation and he was like, oh, you know, like what do you want to get for snacks? And I was like, oh, chips and salsa. And he looks at me and he was like, do you ever choose anything based on taste alone? You know, it was one of those moments where I just felt exposed. And I remember at the time being like, he's right. There's some weirdness about this, but I was like, give me the chips and salsa. You know, that was the only like fun food I would allow myself to eat, you know? And I think the real, during grad school, I started sort of like detaching myself from some of that. I got into therapy with, you know, somebody that was an expert in food and body work. I started to do my own work. And then, you know, I graduated, I did my dietetic internship, got my license and degree, and I started practicing. I worked at a startup company that was very orthorexic in the area. It's not here anymore. But they were doing like nutrigenomics, and we were kind of health coaches looking at labs and gene sequencing and, you know, and it was all very interesting. I learned a lot. I did some research there, but that also, you know, I came into that first job as a Hayes practitioner. I learned about Hayes in grad school. I had, I tell my clients this and they're like, what? But in my nutrition master's, I had, one hour, it was a guest speaker on eating disorders.
1 hour.
1 hour.
Okay.
And that, you know, guest speaker, luckily for me, was practice from a health at every size perspective. And it was the first time I had heard about it. I'm in a small fat body now. As a child, you know, I was bullied about my body. I was teased. I always kind of, the way I describe it, I always kind of fluctuated between fatness and thinness. Actually, as a kid, you know, I wasn't even fat. I just wasn't thin. And I think about this, one of my favorite movies as a kid was Now and Then. I don't know how old you are, Now and Then, it came out sometime in the 80s, maybe. And I had rewatched it as an adult and there's a child on there that was my story. You know, it just wasn't a thin kid. She was, you know, just larger and her friends were all thin. And they, in the movie, as I rewatched it with this lens, it was like, she was the slow one on the bike. She was kind of the mean one. She was the one that was like always eating. And yeah, watching it as an adult, I was like, these are the messages we were getting and that we still constantly get about what it is to, you know, be in a larger body and what it means and all of those like individual choices and myths about what it is to be in a larger body. So that was my body story up until that point. And when I heard about health at every size, I was like, oh yeah, of course. Right. Like this is so logical to me that we can't tell a person's health based on their body size, that we can look at labs, that we can think about their well-being, what is their life like, what sort of support they have, what's their community, right? Like health is so expansive and we whittled it down to a number on the scale or what a body looks like. That, you know, I came into this startup company for my first dietitian job, you know, all proud working downtown Seattle. And I worked there for a year. For the first 6 months, I liked it. It was interesting. I was learning a lot. And then 6 months in, they launched a weight loss program. You know, this is going to be a problem for me, but I really liked the people there. I liked my bosses. I started talking to folks about the research. I did a lot of research, presented, you know, to folks like, I have concerns about this. Can we talk about it differently? You know, and I got a lot of lip service. And once I realized they weren't going to actually make any changes, and I look back on that moment, you know, my sweet 32-year-old self, and I'm like, oh, you poor dear. Like, of course they weren't actually going to do anything. They were going to make the money and launch the weight loss programs. So I left and I started working in the eating disorder field. And yeah, I remember one client I sat with my first year, and I thought to myself in my work with that client, I was like, wow, this was me, you know, like a few years ago, just the clean eating, the purity, the obsessiveness around if I have any sort of indiscretion in what I'm eating. Yeah, so I just continued doing my work, you know, to continue doing my personal work. I gained weight in my recovery, as a lot of people do. I started to feel, you know, the judgment, the looks, the body checking from people in my family, from my friends and community group, that, you know, painful experience that so, so many people have when they do the really profound work of recovery. You know, I was really fueled by my practice and the stories I was hearing and the traumas I was hearing and all the pain I was holding about what anti-fatness, what diet culture, and healthism, how they impact people and their lives and how devastating it is. And I think that really fueled my continued, I'm going to keep going. You know, this isn't, I knew, and I'm a certified body trust provider at the Center for Body Trust in Portland, Oregon, you know, and I went through a long phase of like, no plans. I'm not going to do any, I will not have any external plan. I am just going to listen to my body, which of course took forever, right? Right. Like so hard to do when I had lived in my head, you know, for the first half of part of my life, two decades, 25 years. I'm so glad I did it. Absolutely value my recovery. 1000%. I'll stop talking there. I'm a wordy one.
It's great. You know, probably people listening can very much relate. And, you know, some of the things I wanted to just go back and ask you about was, you know, and I obviously have experience with my own recovery, but also working with a lot of patients is, you know, the reactions of people around you when you're recovering and the body changes and all of that, because it can be a lot. And I'm just wondering for you, like, how did you manage it? Like, what were the things that you were hearing or just in general? Because I know maybe people listening are going, yeah, maybe I'm going through recovery, or the big fear, you know, people may be hearing going, that's why I don't want to go through recovery. I don't want my body to change. So let's talk about that a little bit, like how you navigated that.
Yeah, it's such a good question. And, you know, what I noticed in my own experience, and of course, I was navigating all of my internalized anti-fatness, all of my own, like, I won't be pretty, I won't be acceptable, I won't be loved, I won't be worthy, I'll be unhealthy, you know, and I was obsessed with health. And so I was grappling with all of that, but, you know, with support, and I had great, great support alongside some like really crappy support in our healthcare system, you know, like it takes a while to find the right provider. And I got really lucky in my process. So I guess the number one thing is like that internal work is so, so important because you have to be steady with that to navigate, you know, the body checking. And so here's the thing I think about body checking, because I'm neurodivergent. And so there's a way that my brain works where like I notice change. And so I think there's a thing about body checking. It actually happened with a good friend of mine and colleague recently. I've gained weight in my belly. I'm going through perimenopause, you know, and that very normal process is happening. So I've recently gained weight again. And I noticed my friend, what I thought was body checking me. She's actually a colleague and she does this work, you know, and so she's totally a safe person. But I kind of self-talked my way through in a very different place than I was at the beginning of, you know, when I was in recovery around like, oh, she just noticed a change, you know, like she just noticed that your body looks different and her eyes were drawn to that. It's not necessarily body checking. So that's just like a little tidbit to think about when you think about how people are viewing or interacting with your body. Mm-hmm. But when I was in recovery and I was gaining weight and doing, you know, so much, I mean, I think about my clients and I think about the listeners. This work is brutal. It is so painful. You write like you're recovering and you're reworking all of these internal frameworks. And then my trauma rose to the top because lo and behold, that's what my eating disorder was helping me manage, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was definitely the hardest time of my entire life. You know, as I had friends body checking me, one painful piece is, and this was sort of like all through my childhood, but I started to recognize it as I started doing work. But my dad would, you know, if I would, he doesn't live here, so I would go visit, and if I was thinner, he would compliment me on how good I looked. And you know, as my body gained weight, those comments went away. You know, it's hard. The thing that I offer to my clients, you know, and so much of my client work is like, oh, this is what I needed, right? Like, this is what I needed. This is what I needed to hear. But like reminding folks that my dad's not a bad person, right? Your friend's not a bad person. Your mom's not a bad person. Like these people aren't bad people. They're not trying to be mean to you. They are also socialized in this system. You know, so they think that not being fat is the best thing for you. And that's their work to do. Not mine and not yours. And, you know, I think the other tools that I would recommend for folks, a lot of self-soothing. I think probably we all know what that is, right? Like a lot of sort of like your health is expansive, your eating disorder takes away X, Y, or Z, whatever those things are for you. You know, like I've had conversations with clients, eating disorders are traumatic. Like I don't have any space, right? Like they're oppressive, like eating disorders, depending on who you are and what yours is like, can be life zapping. So like remembering what you're moving away from, and lots of people talk about like, I don't know what it's like to live inside a body that I don't hate. Right? Like, I don't know what it's like to live inside a bigger body, all of these things. And there's this unknown, and that's so scary. And what I encourage people in the beginning is think about what you're moving away from. Think about, you know, why you want to make a change. And that will hopefully give you the bravery to keep going. And then I love it, right? Like, I love it. And maybe I'll try to think about this for my own story, but like when my clients get to that point where they get a taste, they get a taste of what it's like to not be in a battle with your body and food.
Yeah.
And that's when it's like, okay. Okay. This is a little bit more compelling now because I can get a sense of what it's like to recover and to be on the other end of this. And I think that that can kind of naturally propel people to keep going. Yeah. I'm trying to think, you know, what my moment was when I was like, oh, anyway, it might come to me, but yeah.
No, I love that you're sharing all that because it's true. It's so hard to remember why you're doing the recovery and why you're in it. Like especially if, you know, you're living amongst people that are so seeped in diet culture and like to your point, like either not making comments or making comments and it can feel really, you know, it's a struggle. It's a back and forth. It's like, wait, who am I? Where do I fit in? Sometimes it's like, for me, at least it was my identity. A lot of it was like wrapped up in that. So it's like letting go of the eating disorders, like, where am I headed? Who am I? Like, yeah. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
1,000%. Yeah. Yeah. And that pinged something for me. The last thing I'll say is community. Community, 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 like wherever you can find it. I've been privileged in that I live in a major US city in Seattle that's real liberal. So community and close to Portland, community, in-person community was easier for me to find. And I know that that's not the case for a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, the online access that we have now is a blessing slash curse. I don't know how, but here we are. And there's lots of availability to connect with folks doing this work, talking about this work. And so as much as possible as you can curate folks, spaces of safety, you know, I think that we can still be in our lives, you know, and like be, you know, be with the friends and the family as long as there's something that's nourishing to us, you know, if it's not all diet culture and body shaming, right? Like there's some people, you know, I cut out a lot of folks as, you know, as my identity shifted, like you're saying, as I let go of this person obsessed with health, you know, people with, oh, you're the healthiest person I know, you know, and I, you know, thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, as I let that go, right, like people left too. And that's okay. It's so painful. But like the people that came in, oh my gosh, you know, like I would never, yeah, I just, my life is fuller now. Because when you let go of that old identity, you know, the identity from these systems that are causing so much harm, you get to find out who you really are. And then you get to hang out with people who know who they really are. Outside of these scripts that we were handed that says, stay as small as possible.
Yeah, it's like a breath of fresh air. It's like, oh.
Yep.
No pressure.
Yep. I don't have to perform anymore. I can be accepted. People aren't fucking, sorry, weirdos about food. You know, like those conversations are boring. There's a lot of other stuff to talk about.
Yeah. And, you know, you said something else about like not being in your head anymore, but more being in your body. And I'm wondering for you, like, how did you get to that realization that's what was going on or that transition was occurring? Because maybe even people listening going, wait, what is that? Like living in your head versus living in your body. Like, how do I know what I'm doing?
Right. Yeah, man, that's a really good question. Because, yeah, I do that work with clients, you know, and I get blank stares and I understand because I was really, I mean, dissociated. I was dissociated for most of my, you know, up to, you know, 25 or so. I lived inside of my head. And so, yeah, that transition, you know, I think about embodiment and somatics work, although I didn't have that language when I was doing my recovery work. Body trust was a really big framework for me from the Center for Body Trust. And so just starting to like everything, all of my food choices were from my head. What's the absolute most healthiest thing I can possibly eat right now? I mean, the number of vegetables I was eating. Oh my God. Oh my God. I still can't eat a beet to this day. Like, I'm working on it, but like, I just, so starting to be like, okay, every time I go to choose a food, it's from my head. What happens if I, you know, kind of like my ex said, yeah, I actually used his question from the grocery store to start to guide my choices. What sounds good? And the way that I started that was I started to think about the foods that I ate as a kid that I really enjoyed. And it was terrifying. It was terrifying to think about letting my body and my pleasure and my cravings to lead the way. Because at first I was like, I have no idea. I don't know what I like at all. Yeah. And what's interesting is because that was the top layer. That was the first conversation about food. Like, oh, my pleasure? What would taste good? What would like feel good to my body? What? But then as I kept doing my work, it's like, what about other things? Are you living a life that you like? What sort of pleasure do you want in your life? Right. Like, and that's the cool part about recovery work is you start at that top layer and then you keep going and then you start to build a life that you want to be in. And so, yeah, I started with like, okay, well, what sort of foods did I like as a kid? Pizza, nachos, you know, I'll start there. And then I was like, oh, E.L. Fudge cookies, right? Like I loved E.L. Fudge cookies. And so I got some of those, which actually as an adult, I was like, I don't know what my little kid was thinking because these aren't that good. yeah. So I really started with like nostalgic foods. And then I had so many conversations with friends who were clinicians and also doing this work of just like, I don't know what to eat, right? Like, I don't know how to feed myself anymore because my eating disorder was my meal plan. So like now, I took a few cooking classes. I just started exposing my, like, oh, I could make mac and cheese, which was all like, you know, I always had disordered eating and then it just really ramped up to an eating disorder, but I would never allow myself to cook mac and cheese at home, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah. And I think that like within the work, you start to, okay, what sounds good? And it's so, so hard at first. And like, I have so much empathy because I know it. And I also watch my clients go through it. So just being really gentle, thinking about foods as a kid, if that's even available to you, right? Like people have trauma from their childhoods, poverty, a food insecurity, all of these things that make that complex are really wanting to honor that.
And
being really gentle with yourself and just getting curious. And I think that can help you to start to tune in to your body. And that's what I love about my work is I feel like food is an inroad to embodiment and somatics.
Yeah. Everything you're saying, and I hear there's some people like, oh, you know, when people are recovering, they just turn to food that like is quote unquote bad for them. Or, you know, this, I get the challenging questions of, you know, like, why isn't it like the quote unquote healthiest thing or best thing for you to eat, you know, all the things that don't have XYZ in them, or like what's so bad about doing all of that, to your point, like orthorexia. And so, I mean, let's talk about that because I think certainly, you know, there's a lot of thought that like there's a right way to eat or the right foods to eat, and that maybe that's not even about eating disorder, but it's just it's like the morality of foods, right? Like, oh.
Yep.
Right. And so it's the thought of, oh, well, recovery to a lot of people sounds like, oh, you're just telling people to eat all these quote unquote bad foods or be unhealthy. Right. And that's part of, I think, what happens when family members or friends, unbeknownst to themselves, when they're saying these comments, they're not meaning to be mean or harsh. It's just like, oh, does this mean you're getting more unhealthy, or I'm worried about your health? Or they question like, is treatment even working? It seems like maybe it's not, or, you know, all these kinds of things. And so I'm wondering how you navigate those things.
Yeah. Such a good question. And also like, Yeah, it's so interesting. Like, I'm an eating disorder dietitian and I work mostly with adults. And when I talk about my work, people always assume it's binge eating disorder. And I think, right? Like, it's like, because we think that eating disorders don't happen in adults unless it's the like overeating, the eating the junk food, right? Like, so people, a lot of times, not all the times, people's perception of my work is like, oh, getting people to stop eating unhealthy and to right? Like, and I'm like, that couldn't be further from the truth.
It's interesting.
But coming back to, yeah, your question, in my process, you know, and my clients go through this too, around like, am I always going to eat the quote unquote bad foods, right? Am I always going to be eating pizza, nachos, mac and cheese, right?
Nice.
And because I went through a period of really like no rules, I would not let myself cling to any plan. And I cannot tell you how painful that process was. And yeah, I did. I mean, I laugh about this with clients sometimes, but I spent a solid year and I probably the only thing I ate, and this was related to some other stuff happening in my life and digestive stuff, but cheese, crackers, bread, you know, like cheese and starch, like that was, you know, and I'm exaggerating there, but that sort of like fear around like, am I ever going to start to reintroduce, you know, the right, the good, the healthy foods? And I could, you know, if we have time, I could break all of this down more and talk about it, but I'll just stay here with this question. You know, I naturally started I got more space from that year where it was like cheese and bread sustained me. And I had more, you know, healing behind me. I had done a lot of trauma work. And, you know, I started to be like, yeah, kind of, I've always liked kale. Kale gets a bad rap in our community sometimes because it gets a little too much screen time, maybe. Right. But I've always really liked it. You know, I kind of want, you know, a little kale salad. You know, I started to just be able to eat all of the foods easily, naturally, you know, with time, right? But I had to give myself unconditional permission to eat the foods that sounded good and yummy. Like I had to really, really, you know, we talk about it with like restriction. If we're just thinking about like, you know, not enough food in general at all, the body needs that re-nourishment process to build trust and to know that it's not going to be forced into a starvation state again. I think it's a similar process with our nervous system around like, I'm not going to be forced into unpleasurable foods again. And so my body just really needed to know that all the foods were okay. And then it, you know, and then I just started to widen and, you know, now it really is. Yeah, I think I'm having a memory. One of the, you know, I sort of got a friend who's a doctor in the area to help me with cooking because I was in that place of like, I don't know how to feed myself. And I remember we went to the farmer's market together and she was like, just walk around and like, see what looks good. And I was like, what? Like, I don't know. I have no, kind of to your point, like I have no idea I don't know. And I remember that moment because now, you know, I go to the farmer's market every week with my partner. It's like my church. I love it. And I'm just like, ooh, those carrots look good. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. Spring turnips. I love them. Right. Like, and so my palate is so much more nuanced now and sophisticated, really. I don't know. I don't like that word, but it's just like, I can trust that I'm drawn to stuff. And I never, never had that capacity before because it was just like, get as many vegetables as possible and eat them all as much as you can. Like, yeah. So I didn't really know what I liked.
No, that is so true. I'm just remembering so many times I get phone calls from people at, you know, the grocery store for the first time, like, I don't know what to eat. I don't know what I'm doing, you know, kind of having almost panic attacks. Like, oh, I'm lost. I'm actually lost here. And
right.
I think that's a normal reaction at first, like, because to your point, it's like some other quote unquote expert, whatever diet was like telling you what to eat and how to eat and when to eat and all the things. And so it was like left to your own self. It's like, you just kind of lost at first. Like, I actually don't know, which is like so, you know, to me so sad, because it's like, oh, you know, we got to do it several times a day. And so, but yeah. that is, if anyone's listening and going through that, that is so normal. And there, I think that's the point where most people go, it's just so much easier to either, like, I wish I could just take a pill and not eat, or it's so much easier to be on a diet because then I don't have to think about it.
Yes. And it takes us away from that shame. I'm a 25-year-old that doesn't know how to feed myself. A very basic, and especially as a female, right? Like that is the labor we're socialized into, is that we're going to be the caretakers, we're going to be the cooks, the people that prepare the food, right? Like, and so it's kind of socialized, woven into our identities. And, you know, I was 25, so I was an adult, and I was like, I have no idea how to do this. And then there was a lot of shame in that. And I wonder, as I'm talking, if that shame, like you said, chases people back to their eating disorder, because at least that makes me feel competent in this place that's so essential and vulnerable, and connected to my identity, if that resonates with people.
Yeah. And I think too, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, but it's almost like this scary thing of left to my own devices, I'm going to, like, you know, be out of control and eat all these things and it's never going to stop. And then, you know, so yep. Yeah, exactly. And
yep.
I don't know if you find that too.
Oh, 1,000%. Yeah. In my work, you know, and I think that that's why, you know, people still diet, like, oh, I have to control this, or, or I'll be out of control. And that's where I, you know, talk about the habituation effect. And just like when our bodies are, bodies, systems, minds are continually exposed to foods neutrally, right? When there's not this power dynamic that we give to food, when we say one food is good and one food is bad. And then, like, to deepen that, one food is good, and if you eat it, you're a good person.
Yep.
Right? That morality. And one food is bad, and if you eat it, you're a bad person.
Right.
Right? And so then in recovery, like, right, as clinicians, we're asking people to, you know, trust themselves. And if you've been eating vegetables for 5 years, like I was, it's like, yeah, I fucking want mac and cheese. Sorry. I keep cussing. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. I want mac and cheese. I want right. Like my body was undernourished, right? Like I was at the thinnest I ever was. I remember looking at a photo of me on the farm and a friend had sent it to me and I was shocked. And I was with my sister and she saw it and she was like, you look sick. And I was like, that was my first thought too. I look sick. But of course I was on cloud nine because I was the thinnest I'd ever been. Yeah. So, I kind of lost my train of thought. That was just a memory that kind of popped back. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And I think a lot of people don't realize it at the time. It's almost like looking back, you know, then realizing, like, because obviously if you're just eating all these vegetables, you're not getting all the nutrition and all the fuel and all the alls that you need. But at the time, you're probably thinking, I'm being so quote unquote healthy. I'm good.
Yep, I'm good. I'm good. I'm good. I'm okay. I'm acceptable. And orthorexia was the perfect, you know, quote unquote one for me. And I think that this is what I see in our culture of healthism. And I've written about this, and I knew, you know, deep down, right? Like, I don't know if everyone has this experience, but for me, there's always a little whisper of like, right? Like, I think it's my wise mind. I think DBT talks about it, or right. A little bit of like, this is maybe not what's best or whatever. And that voice, you know, in the height of my orthorexia was like, I was sort of, this is about health. I'm healthy. And that's my identity. I'm the healthiest person people know. I'm just a healthy person. But that little whisper was like, this is about thinness. This is about thinness and the access you're getting with it. And that's what this is about. But I could sort of perform that it wasn't about that, that it was about my health. And so I'm a good person because I'm performing health in these ways and sort of protecting me from that stigma that we give to folks with eating disorders, which is like, you're vain, you're obsessed with your objective form and thinness, you know? And I think that, right, like culturally we've seen that shift, like, oh, diets don't work, so we're just going to do lifestyle changes and we're going to just be healthy. And it's like, well, same thing, different packaging.
Exactly. It's just said nicer, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And, you know, you said something like, what thinness allowed you to gain or access to. And I'm wondering, you know, what you felt like it allowed you to gain access to.
Yeah, totally. You know, at the time I was single and interested in men. The male gaze was a lot easier. I felt more confident. I want to put that in quotation marks. I feel like my ego was allowed to flourish because I felt more confident in my thin body. I won't say it was actual confidence. It was like my ego was like, oh, I'm sexier. I'm, you know, men are attracted to me and I get more opportunities in that way. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't true confidence. So, and that mattered to me. Clothing. Oh my gosh. You know, like I love fashion. I love clothes. I always have. I could go to thrift stores and, you know, buy a pair of pants for $10 and they fit. So those, and then I think just the sort of like, you know, kind of coming back to my dad example, like, oh, you look so good. You look so healthy. All the compliments that just really fueled my ego, not my confidence, but my ego of like, oh, I get all of the sort of like placards. Is that a word? I don't know. That we put on thinness. Yeah. But I was more unwell than I've ever been. Well, I don't know if that's true, but I was unwell. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sure people listening are going, yeah, like, why would I want to give that up if I get all the things that you just said, right? Like, what's going to happen if I let go of my eating disorder and I get, quote unquote, healthier, my body changes? Is all of that going to go away? I don't want to give those things up, right? Because I think that needs to be a discussion of, you know, it's these fears.
Yeah, 1,000%. Yeah. And the way that I talk about it, right, with my clients, like really a lot of course, yeah, we live in this world where anti-fatness is a thing and thinness is prioritized and privileged, right? This is a privilege oppression conversation here. And so like, of course, you feel nervous about if your body will change and how that will impact your life. And, you know, and this comes up a lot with dating, right? Like the first example I gave was like, yeah, it felt more accessible to me to have the male gaze and to feel confident dating. So that conversation comes up around like, I won't find a partner, I'll lose my partner. Mm-hmm. And it's like, do we want our partnerships built on a house of cards? Right? Like built on a performance. Do we want a partnership where we are obligated to keep our body a certain way or we will lose them? Mm-hmm. That's not, you know, kind of coming back to, I felt like I had confidence, but it wasn't actual confidence. I think we're looking at the difference between pretend stuff and actual reality in life. Like, my mentor, Hillary Canavy at the Center for Body Trust, I think she posted this on Instagram, but she's so brilliant to me. The way we've been socialized to see beauty keeps us from actually falling in love, right? Like, If we're just like, oh, I have to have a thin person that's tall with blonde hair, you know, it's usually all about whiteness, that I'm like, that reflects back to my ego that I've done it and I'm happy. But are we actually happy? I think right. That's what we want, right? Like, we want to actually be happy, not to pretend that we're happy because we've checked off the script that we were told about what it is to be happy.
Right. I love that you're saying this too, because it's like our bodies are constantly going to be changing. That's the one thing that is known, right? Over time. It is. And so it's like, I love that you said the house of cards, right? It's like, what's really connecting you to somebody? Like, do they really know you? And again, it's that constant pressure of like, what happens if my body changes over time? Like, are they going to leave? Like, how sustainable is this relationship? Like, that's kind of, it's superficial.
And a trap, right? A trap to keep you disconnected and to keep you sort of disordered into objectification.
Mm-hmm. And again, and I'm sure you're not saying like being in a thin body, if that's your genetic makeup and that's where you're like supposed to be, it's like, there's nothing bad with that. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with any size or shape or body at all. Yes. It's just saying when our society says that's the only one that's acceptable or deemed attractive or told is healthy, that's the problem.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Yeah, totally. 1,000%. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Cause certainly, you know, when people recover, it's like what, 80% genetically determined what your body is, what you appear, right?
Right. Yeah. So, yeah. And, you know, that's influenced by so many things, right? Like genetics and so many other things, but like dieting. The grief I sit with my clients around, if I hadn't put on a diet at age 5, that's my story. Well, that's not totally my story. My mom told me at a certain point when I was, you know, sharing with my parents my own recovery story. I don't know if I was using that language then with them, but, you know, my work and the things I was learning, my mom was like, oh yeah, your pediatrician, you know, recommended a diet for you at age five. And I was privileged that I had a mom who was like, I'm not going to do that.
Good mom.
So, right. Like, so I got the messaging, right? Like I internalized at a young age, cause I think I was like 8 and I found the Wonder Soup diet in some magazine. And here I was in the kitchen making a bunch of just vegetable soup. And I remember putting it in the freezer because that's all I was going to eat. So the message got through, even though my mom was like, I'm not going to put my kid on a diet.
Yeah.
My mom hated her body. I don't think that that's uncommon. I'm hopeful. I think I'm on track here, right? I'm pretty sure I will be the first woman in my lineage to, I don't know about my sister, but to not die hating their body. Cause that, you know, that I think that's the story for a lot of folks. But and so my clients, you know, lots of them have similar stories. I was put on a diet at these young ages. And what we know really consistently from the research, and we're seeing this come out on the GLP-1s now too, dieting, the consistent outcome of dieting and restriction is weight gain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, there's like almost hard to say that because then it's like, I don't know how you feel. There's like this dicey moment of like not wanting to perpetuate dieting, saying like, oh, if you diet, you're going to gain weight. And like, I don't want to perpetuate, like, weight gain's bad. It's not that. It's saying like the one thing you're trying to prevent is ultimately the thing that's going to happen. Ultimately, that's more of the message.
1,000%. Yeah. And thank you for clarifying that. Right. Like, Yeah, 1,000%. Like, weight gain is normal. It's fine. All bodies are okay. You know, fatness and weight gain in this culture as it is now leads to oppression, you know, loss of access, clothing, seating, airplane flights. And that's all just real. That's not a problem with the body. That's a problem with our structural system. And part of that structural system is saying we will solve the problem of fatness, and I won't even use the O word, by doing the one thing, dieting, that we know doesn't work, and that leads to, right? Like, so it is the definition of insanity, right? My other mentor, Dana Sturdivant, talks about the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. And that's what we're doing here. And I mean, GLP-1 environment has just really increased it.
We're in for something.
Yep.
Yeah. My goodness, Virginia, we have talked length. I know we could probably talk for another few hours about all of this. Yep. I mean, gosh, I appreciate all you shared about yourself. And I know probably people listening are like having a lot of just light bulb moments or things in their head that are spinning. But my goodness, I know you're doing some awesome work out there helping a lot of people. You know, if anyone's listening, they're like, okay, how do I work with Virginia? How do I find her? Like, how can they do that?
Yeah. Awesome. Thanks. My business is The Radical Dietitian. Radicaldietitian.com is my website. I'm on Instagram, The Radical Dietitian. I'm on Facebook, but I'm really not as active there, but it just reposts my Instagram stuff, The Radical Dietitian. I have a clinical practice where I work with folks with eating disorders and folks looking to heal their relationship to food and body. And I also mentor clinicians. I work with dietitians and therapists in the field also doing this work.
Fantastic. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. Any last final words before we end?
Oh, I just really appreciate the opportunity. I love talking about this stuff. Yeah, it's just really nice to be here.
All right. Well, I appreciate you taking the time. Thank you so, so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much for listening today. Behind the Bite podcast is created by me, Dr. Christina Castanini, as part of the Los Angeles Tribune Podcast Network and produced by the Tweaky Tales. I love hearing from my listeners. So if you like the show, please like, rate, and subscribe to it on whatever platform you're on. And for anyone who wants to understand their relationship with food better, or who might be wondering if they have an eating disorder, I have a free 9-week e-course at my website. Just go to www.behindthebitepodcast.com to get your free e-course today. Please note, this podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regard to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither host, the publisher, or the guests are rendering legal, clinical, or other professional information. If you want or need a professional, you should find one to work with who can address your individual needs and situation.